You're listening to The Lead, a podcast where we learn how to get ahead in the media industry from the people that did. I'm Daniel Funky. Today on the show, we have Alex Jones and Steve Oney, two of the most accomplished journalists I've ever talked to. But first, a word from our sponsor. This podcast was created by the Cox Institute for Journalism Innovation, Management, and Leadership as part of its Innovation Fellowship Program. To learn more, go to grady.uga.edu/Cox Institute. I'm so glad to have Alex and Steve join me on the show today. Alex is the former director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He also won the Pulitzer Prize in the 1980s for his work covering the newspaper business for the New York Times. Steve is a long-form journalist and author of books such as And the Dead Shall Rise, a nonfiction account of the death of Mary Fagan and the lynching of Leo Frank. Here's our conversation. How are you both doing today?
Good. Great, thanks.
Great. So thanks so much for coming on the show. I know you guys have tight schedules here at the Grady College of Journalism, and I appreciate you both taking time out of your day to come speak to me. So thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So you both are extremely accomplished journalists. I tried to just go through your bios very briefly before this, and they're just too long. So I'd love it if we started out just by having you both say, like, which of your experiences are your favorite, and which ones have you learned the most from?
Alex?
Well, I think I learned just about everything I learned that was most valuable about journalism at the newspaper that I was first at, the Athens Daily Post-Athenian in Athens, Tennessee, the Athens of Tennessee, as we say. I was working for an older editor named Neil Ensminger, who couldn't type and was a journalist and editor from the old school. And he really taught me all of the essentials about the kinds of dilemmas you face and how you go about trying to engage them. You know, I was at the New York Times after that. I've been at Harvard, but I would say when it comes to learning, that was where I learned.
I learned the most at the Atlanta Journal and Constitution Sunday Magazine, which is now defunct, but had started in 1912 and was the second oldest Sunday magazine in the country. And I got a job there at age 22 as a full-fledged staff writer. And I was naive and ignorant, and yet I was given a chance to experiment and write, and I was driven by the magazine's need for stories, fresh stories every week. And I learned on the job and got paid for doing so. And it was an incredibly fortuitous thing to happen at such an early age. And I've subsequently gone on to make my living mostly as a magazine writer, writing freelance, writing on staff, writing for Esquire and Playboy and the New York Times. And but it was those 5 years at the Atlanta Journal and Constitution in my early 20s that really made a difference.
Great. And throughout the day, you've both been visiting Grady, you know, visiting old faculty members and people you know from the past. And I think, Alex, specifically, you've been talking to a lot of classes about ethics. And given the current 2016 election cycle, there's been a lot of important reporting on the election. And I'd just be interested to see what your takes are on that.
Well, what I said to the ethics class may have been surprising to them, because what I tried to get them to focus on was the genuine risk that the New York Times was taking in publishing Donald Trump's tax return, and that all news organizations are, you know, taking when they do, for ethical reasons, for the best journalistic reasons, an idealistic thing like publishing something which may put them in risk of being sued. The way things are now, if you see what happened to Gawker, a very rich man can simply use litigation to put you out of business, which means that you have to be very mindful of what the real, you know, vulnerabilities are. I don't think the New York Times hesitated a moment in its decision to publish the tax return. I think they did the right thing. But I think that they may well face a significant, you know, legal challenge from Donald Trump, whether he wins or loses. And I think also that news organizations that are not as well funded economically will be, you know, I think mindful of what happened to Gawker, because they were basically put out of business by a rich man.
Yeah, not to put Gawker on the same plane as the New York Times, but Nick Denton established a really valuable entity in Gawker, with Gizmodo, Jezebel, Defamer, Wonkette, and because this Silicon Valley billionaire who was angry for being outed in Gawker's technology blog backed a lawsuit against them, that entity is now gone from the face of the earth. And it was, people loved it, people hated it. It could be very, very nasty, but it was always entertaining, and a lot of smart people work there, and they now not only don't entertain us, they don't have jobs anymore just because of a billionaire who decided to mount litigation that Gawker's owner, Nick Denton, couldn't afford.
You know, a lot of these stories, especially with regard to the election, and they do present these issues in terms of the law, but a lot of the times they take a lot of words to explain. And we live in the age of social media where everything needs to be, you know, 140 characters. It needs to be able to be on someone's phone screen for them to care. So, you know, Steve, you've written a lot of long form pieces for magazines such as Esquire and the New York Times Magazine. So how do you get people to care about these longer form issues when they just want to read it on their phone?
You have to write well to hold people's attention, and you always have to be aware that they have 1,000 better things to do than read what you've written. And not that you're slavishly writing punchlines to try to keep them engaged, but you are aware that they're making a choice to spend time with you. And I'm hoping that in the long view of long form, there's going to be a change, you know, in the way fast food went to the slow food movement, and now we are enamored of so-called artisanal food, and people really spend a lot of time on their meals and on their menus, and dining has returned as a pleasurable, not only pleasurable, but we're interested in the ingredients and where they're from. I think journalism is somewhat the same way. Twitter is so unsatisfying. To read a great piece of journalism, and I have so many journalists I admire, to read, you know, any given issue of The New Yorker and to appreciate the thought and imagination and hard work that went into pulling off something like that, and then the pleasure you get from reading it, I think reading is pleasurable. That would be, it's one of the greatest pleasures in my life. I read for fun, and I try to, even though I take on serious subjects, I'm always hoping that someone's going to read this not because they have to, but because they want to.
I think another pattern we've seen this election cycle and this year more broadly is that a lot of the big important stories people share on social media, ironically, are from these big newspapers like the New York Times or the Washington Post. And Alex, you've written substantially about the subject. You won a Pulitzer Prize in 1987 for your New York Times reporting on the fallout from this Kentucky family that lost all their media properties. So I'd just be interested to see, you know, what you think about the conversation surrounding the fall of newspapers when you do see them still doing important work like this.
I think that newspapers have been the sort of engine for serious journalism, you know, for the 20th century and beyond, and they still are in many respects, simply because they have the resources and the training in their staffs to do that kind of work. It's not that there are not important work being done by other people, but I think in general, it's mostly coming from newspapers, and now it's coming from newspapers but being delivered online in other ways, and I think that is the future for newspapers journalistically. They're not going to be just words on paper, but they're going to be journalistic, you know, high-quality reported journalism that people get in a variety of forms. That said, newspapers economically have got to figure out a way to solve the economic, you know, riddle of how they can remain economically viable in this environment when they have lost so much of the source of their revenue in classified advertising and things like that.
And you make complimentary points. I get sent maybe 10 links to stories a day, so much that I wish people would stop because I can't read it all, but nobody ever links me to a tweet. People link me to fascinating articles in The Atlantic or the Atlanta Journal-Constitution or name the publication, and these are almost all long writerly articles that dig into a subject and illuminate them with style and flair. And so people are reading. I think people crave really smart writing because that elevates it above the noise, basically, of the Twitter sphere, and because basically all that is noise, and you want understanding, not noise.
Absolutely. So for my last question, I'd just like to know, you guys have both had such long careers in journalism. Do you think that same career trajectory is possible today, given the economic issues facing not only the newspaper industry, but the media industry more broadly? Do you think students today could achieve the same kind of success? And if so, what things should they be doing now to prepare for that?
I've got an opinion on that. One, I don't know exactly what their career trajectory will be, but I do think there are going to be opportunities out there, and there are opportunities out there now, especially for people who are coming out of places like Grady with a lot of both journalistic and technological knowledge. But I think the thing that is key is going to be keeping the quality and the sort of focus on doing the job right. That's what I think is going to set you apart. And the key to that, in part, is going to be an ability to write. Because no matter what kind of journalism you're doing, even if it's, you know, tweeting, you're going to need to be able to write well. And that is going to set you apart. When I'm asked by students, what is the most important skill that I can learn while I'm in school? I tell them, learn to write clearly and well, and you will set yourself apart from virtually 90% of the population.
My answer is the world really has changed, and I'm not sure what's ahead. When I got out of Grady in 1975, the basic feeling was in journalism, it was impossible to fail. No matter how poorly you did, there would be somebody else who took you. And there was a witty line from Hunter Thompson about that time in Rolling Stone saying that the pyramid paragraph has supported more lame brains than anything except the peacetime army. And that assumption is now no longer true. I think it's a more perilous time, but I do think people are reading. And, BuzzFeed has 5 dedicated national reporters who are writing long stories for a smart former national correspondent of the Los Angeles Times. There are, and weekly and local newspapers are also really strong. There's really good work being done, really honorable work, work from which a recent Grady grad can not only earn a living, but can learn about every facet of life. I still think that's the best first job, and those jobs are still out there.
Steve and Alex, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Alex Jones is the former director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Steve Oney is a long-form journalist and author of books such as And the Dead Shall Rise. Thank you for listening to The Lead. Today's episode was produced by Daniel Funke with special help from Keith Herndon, director of the Cox Institute at the University of Georgia. For more interviews with media leaders, go to soundcloud.com/theleadpodcast or find us on Twitter @theleadpodcast.